Thanks for listening to A Little More Conversation. I'm Ben O'Hara Byrne. On this Monday night, do we sell friendship short? Can a friend be your soulmate? Those are some of the questions tackled in a new book called The Other Significant Others, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center. And the author joins me to explain how she met with dozens of people who've made that choice and the challenges we all face in a society where friendship is often relegated to a supporting role. You are what you eat, the old saying goes, and a new study into the consumption of ultra-processed foods suggests eating a lot of them is not good for your health. It finds UPFs are shortening lives and worsening people's health on at least 32 major health parameters. We dig into the findings and learn what they mean. Former Quebec Premier and longtime Mulroney-era Cabinet Minister Jean Charest joins me to share his memories of the late Prime Minister who passed away at the age of 84 last Thursday and some stories about their time together, including a visit to Florida to see him late last month. Today marks 30 years since one of Canada's comedy greats passed away. John Candy was just 43 when he died in his sleep in Mexico while filming a movie called Wagons East. His son, Chris Candy, who's now 39, an actor, producer, and radio host in LA, joins me to share some of his stories and reflect on his father's still larger-than-life legacy. But first, it's by-election night in Durham, Ontario, the seat left open by the resignation of former Conservative Party leader Erin O'Toole, and a new face of the party will be the new MP for that riding. Lawyer, political commentator, and author Jamil Javani took well over 50% of the vote, a strong showing. We look at the broader implications of the result and how Javani will likely be given a pretty high profile in Pierre Poilievre's party. Let's head to Durham tonight. That's where Oshawa is, by the way. It's the Ontario riding of Durham, and there was a by-election going on as we speak, or at least the counting is going on as we speak. This is to replace the former Conservative leader, Erin O'Toole, who, of course, resigned his seat last spring. It's been a fairly sure thing from the get-go that the Conservatives would once again win a seat that they've held since 2004, and Jamil Javani, a lawyer and commentator, is running for them. According to the networks, he has indeed won this by-election. It's still, there's only about half the polls reporting of the 225 polls reporting, but he's sitting with about 54% of the vote right now. That's a very comfortable and, by all accounts, insurmountable lead at this point in the vote count, well ahead of his Liberal rival, local municipal councillor Robert Rock, who's at about 23.6% right now. Now, Rock initially sought the Conservative nomination, but says he decided to run for the Liberals because the Conservative Party no longer spoke to his values. The NDP have someone named Chris Borgia, who's the president of the Durham Region Labour Council. He's in third right now with 11.5% of the vote. Still a bit more to come. I mean, there are a lot of subplots to look out for tonight. By-elections, specifically ones in fairly safe ridings, don't exactly move the earth, but there are things to look out for. One of them is, how is the People's Party doing? Because they've been creeping up in that riding in previous elections. I think they're up to about 5.5% in the last federal election. Tonight, Patrick Conlon, who's running for the PPC, is at about 4.7%. So again, I think some of the things coming in, how big a win will this be for the Conservatives? They put a lot of heavy hitters in that riding over the past weeks as the campaigning was going on. Jamil Javani is a well-known name, so a bit of a star candidate for them as well. And I think tonight they were trying to show that it's not just poll numbers that show them well ahead, that they could also do very well in this election. And for second place, of course, the big question is, where does the more progressive vote stick its vote? Does it stick with the Liberals? Is it divided between the Liberals and the NDP? So a lot of different things going on in the riding tonight. We'll keep an eye on the results as they continue to come in. But Mitch Hempel is with us now. He's Director of Policy and a Conservative Strategist with Enterprise Canada. Mitch, thanks for your time tonight.
Happy to be here, Ben.
I guess, this was sort of, looking at the results the way they stand now, this was pretty much going according to plan, as far as I can tell, for the Conservatives to this evening.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to have anything to complain about, that's for sure.
Yeah. Tell me a bit about that. I mean, tell me a bit of going in. I think the assumption was this was not a riding that the Conservatives were going to lose, but what were some of the sort of benchmarks you were going to be looking for tonight to dub this a success?
So the question, there's a couple of things. The first question is, where does the final vote percentage kind of land, right? So the last three elections, 2015, 2019, 2021, Erin O'Toole, my old boss, kind of fell between about 43% of the vote and about 48% of the vote. He got as high as about 51, I think, in the by-election he was elected in 2013. So 2013, 2014. Anyway, right. So like kind of where does that vote land, right? What percentage of the vote are they looking at? Right now, they're about 55, which is slightly higher than the Conservative Party was in 2011 when Stephen Harper won a majority government and Bev Oda was the MP. So they're having a really good night. Like if they're beating where they were in 2011 when they were winning a majority government, they're having an exceptional night right now.
What about on the for the other parties? I think there were certainly, I mean, the Liberals also went quite hard on this one. I think this they thought this might be a riding where they could show that they mightn't be performing as badly as the polls might suggest. Right now, they're down around 23%. That's much lower than they've averaged in previous elections when they're up near 30, 32, at least in the last two federal elections.
Yeah, so like the Liberal vote in that riding has been consistently kind of climbing since that sort of low ebb in 2011, you know, 35%, 32%, even 30% kind of in there. They're not hitting that mark tonight. And so that's a concern if you're a Liberal. They put some firepower into that riding. So cabinet ministers have been there recently. Bill Blair was there today. Seamus O'Regan was there at the end of last week. Ahmed Hussein was over there over the weekend. So it's not like the government has just gave up on the seat. It's not like they walked away from it. They did put some resources into it, but and like worth noting that when he kicked off the parliamentary session this winter, the prime minister shouted out their Durham candidate in his remarks to caucus, which were televised nationally. So there has been some focus from the Liberals in this. You can look at this one of two ways if you're the Liberals. The first of which is just it's not a good night. The upside to this is that they weren't threatened by the NDP in any way. Like if you force me to look for a silver lining to this gray cloud, there's still 12 points ahead of the NDP. And so what that should indicate is that they still remain the progressive option to Pierre Poilievre. It's just in this riding, the progressive option to Pierre Poilievre is so far behind Pierre Poilievre.
Yeah, together the NDP and the Liberals right now at about 34% to about 55%, as you mentioned, are for the Conservative candidate. Interesting for the NDP. I mean, I know this isn't necessarily, it was once relatively fertile ground for the NDP, but not in recent elections. And I suppose as far as we're looking at the sort of this, how the polling nationally is reflecting the strength of those two parties right now, what we're seeing tonight is, and Jamil Javani just climbed above 55%, by the way, is about on par with what we're seeing federally, because you see the NDP at down around 11% and the Liberals polling around 23% in what is a pretty strong Conservative riding.
Yeah, it's as bad a night as it is for the Liberals, it is a dramatically worse night for the New Democrats. Because the numbers suggest a few things. First, you're right to point out this isn't unfertile ground for the NDP. The town of Bowmanville is in the southern end of this riding. There's a lot of, you know, unionized members of the Power Workers Union that live there because the Darlington nuclear facility is so close. There's a lot of unionized auto workers that live there because GM, of course, is in Oshawa. So it's a fairly, especially in that southern area around Bowmanville, it's a fairly what you would kind of call blue-collar, union-heavy kind of area. The NDP is nowhere to be found. Like there's a decent chance they don't get their deposit back on tonight, which is a difficult position to be in if you're Jagmeet Singh. Go ahead.
Yeah, finish your thought. I was just looking at what the PPC were doing tonight, and I had a question that I thought was pretty interesting. But go ahead on the NDP.
I think if I was a New Democratic strategist right now, I would be saying the conference and supply agreement is doing us no help. Sorry. The government is radically unpopular and people are associating us with the government. We got to get, this is a straitjacket for us at this point. Like it's a boat anchor. We got to get out of this.
Interesting. One of the things that was one of the other subplots coming into this was this whole idea that the People's Party had been taking some votes away from the Conservatives in previous elections. Not that it had threatened Erin O'Toole in any way, shape, or form, but that was sort of a small trend that was happening. What's interesting tonight is the PPC vote is down, but not substantially. And yet the Conservative vote is up fairly substantially. So you're wondering, where are those votes coming from? Are they new voters or are they actually grabbing votes from the Liberals tonight?
So it's important not to read too much into by-elections. Like we're looking at, you know, 58% of polls are reporting voter turnout right now, it looks to be about 10% by the end of the night.
Yeah, it's very low.
It might push 20, right? Like, you're not looking at high voter turnout, and it's hard to extrapolate from numbers like that too much. You risk reading too much into the cards on that. I would say from the PPC perspective, like, there is a certain percentage of the electorate that is just, they're none of the above voters. They are, you know, whatever you're for, I'm again at kind of voters. And the PPC was always an attractive option to that. One of the things we have seen over the last election, we will see it going forward, is the Green Party used to be an attractive home for a lot of voters like that. People who would go out and vote because they believe they live in a democracy and they should, but they just hate everything about the establishment parties. And what we have seen where the Green Party and the PPC are in the same seat is they do take votes from the Conservatives, especially out in Western Canada. But in Ontario and out east, they take some, they interestingly do real damage to the Green Party's numbers. Like, if you look at the Green Party tonight, they're at like 2.1% of the vote. Whereas, like, if you look at past Green elections, you know, they're up at 4-5% in that riding, even 11% at one point in the not too, too distant past. So, like, this is just a bad night all around, I think, for them. But the PPC, like, there's some people you just can't persuade, to quote Cool Hand Luke.
Mitch Hempel is my guest. He's director of policy and a conservative strategist with Enterprise Canada. He, of course, knows Aaron O'Toole well. Jamil Chavani was the candidate running for the Conservatives to replace him. He has a sizable and growing lead. He's already been declared the winner tonight, so we'll have a new Conservative MP in Ottawa shortly. He's up at 55. Mitch, every time I look, his vote count climbs a little bit more. So he's up into the mid-50s now, which is a pretty solid showing. Tell me a bit about Jamil Chavani, because I get the sense that he has all the makings of being someone who could be fairly prominent in Pierre Poilievre's Conservative Party right now.
Yeah, I think if you just look at the last Conservative convention, he was given a fairly prominent speaking spot in it, and the party did a lot of promotional material around his remarks. So clearly they view him as somebody who could be quite central in a Pierre Poilievre government. He's a lawyer. He graduated from Yale. He's a cancer survivor. He's written a fairly I think it might be a best-selling book, actually, about his experiences in his life to this point. And so he's got a lot of name recognition among sort of core conservative activists. And his broadcasting experience, he hosted a radio show for a little while, as well as his commentary experience, making him the kind of communicator that we've seen Pierre Poilievre really kind of attract the party to this point, not just Jamil, but Sabrina Matto, who's a former National Post columnist, is seeking the nomination just north of Toronto in Richmond Hill. So that's another one to keep an eye on. That's the kind of MP that Pierre Poilievre, I think, is really kind of positioning close to the core of his team as he looks for the next election.
Yeah, an easy question for you at the end, because I think this one, as far as we can tell, Jamil Chavani is pretty much, and we've talked about this, what that indicates, and it is just a by-election, but you must have a favorite John Candy movie, Mitch, because we're going to talk to John Candy's son next.
You know what, I probably would go with, like, personally, I would probably go with Cool Runnings, but a lot of people are going to go, I think, with Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, and it's hard for me to beat that, but I will stick with Cool Runnings. I do love that movie.
I love Cool Running. Chris Candy, his son, actually was in Jamaica for a month when he was filming that back in the early 90s. Listen, Mitch, thanks so much for your time tonight. I appreciate it.
Have a good one, Ben.
Want to hurt me? Go right ahead if it makes you feel any better. I'm an easy target. Yeah, you're right. I talk too much. I also listen too much. I could be a cold-hearted cynic like you. But I don't like to hurt people's feelings. Well, you think what you want about me. I'm not changing. I like me. My wife likes me. My customers like me. Because I'm the real article. What you see is what you get.
There you have it. John Candy, of course, one of Canada's great actors, great comedic actors, a scene there from Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. It was 30 years ago today that John Candy passed away, way too young, of course. He was making a movie called Wagons East in Mexico when it happened. And we've been thinking back about John Candy today. I was reading about him again last night, watched a few clips today, wondering what your favorite John Candy movie was. Let me know, 1-877-399-9898, 1-877-399-9898. Of course, if you're old enough to remember him back on SCTV, I mean, he was fantastic. That was a fantastic show back in the late 70s into the early 80s with a whole cast of characters that were just awesome. I actually met John Candy in Edmonton when they moved the show out there very briefly because I had a family member in the show. You may be able to guess by my family name who that might be. But very briefly met John Candy when I was a very young boy and was just thought, wow, what a larger than life character he really is. By the time, of course, he'd already made some appearances in the Blues Brothers, Stripes, National Lampoon's Vacation, but things were about to take off big time for the Toronto-born comedian. Through the 80s, especially working with director John Hughes, Candy would become one of Hollywood's kind of A-list comedy stars, appearing in such hits as Splash, Spaceballs, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, of course, Summer Rental, Uncle Buck, and Home Alone, who can forget Polka King, Gus Polinski.
Tell me, have you ever gone on vacation and left your child home?
No. No. But I did leave one at a funeral parlor once. Yeah, it was terrible, too. You know, I was all distraught and everything, you know, the wife and I. We left the little tyke there in the funeral parlor all day. All day. You know, we went back at night when we came to our senses. And there he was. Apparently, he was there alone all day with a corpse. Now, he was okay, you know, after 6-7 weeks. And I came around, started talking again.
John Candy, with Catherine O'Hara, by the way, in that scene from Home Alone. He took a serious turn in Oliver Stone's JFK, but it was 30 years ago today. I was mentioning that at the age of 43, he passed away in his sleep in Mexico while filming a movie called Wagons East. His legacy has grown over the years. He has a star on Canada's Walk of Fame. There was John Candy Day in Toronto back in 2020 on October 31st to mark what would have been his 70th birthday. But to my next guest, he was more than just the comedy and the comedian and the actor and the Canadian legend. He was dad. Chris Candy was the youngest of John's two kids, alongside sister Jennifer, born to artist Rosemary Hobor and John. He was born in 1984, Chris was, and so he was still very young when his dad passed. He's followed in his father's footsteps to some extent, but also blazed his own trail. He's also worked with the famed Second City, but acting, producing, writing, hosting his own podcast. He has a weekly radio show called Noise Pollution on LA's KLXU, and it's a real honor to welcome Chris Candy to the show tonight. Thanks for your time.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure being here.
It was interesting. I was sort of seeing that today is getting a lot of attention, in the U.S. and here at home. And how is that? How is that for you? Wow, 30 years.
I am honored by it. I think that one of the things that's comforting with it is that so many people that love my father and still love my father, and so much time has passed. And it is a blessing that he is someone who is to be remembered and wants to be remembered by so many people. It just means the world to me to see kind of the love and attention he gets, be it his birthday or be it the day he passed away.
I know for quite, and this is understandable for quite some time as you're growing up and trying to make your own way and find yourself and so on, that it's not easy to talk about. It's not easy to be in, I don't know if I want to say it's a shadow, but it's not easy to be a part of that legacy necessarily. And I know that for quite a while, you didn't really want to talk a lot about your father and what had happened and so on. That's changed.
Yeah, I think you have this growth as a person. And I know I could speak to myself as I spent a lot of time trying to figure out who I was. And it is overwhelming when you're younger, having someone whose identity is so big. And my father was larger than life. And I knew that, but I didn't really understand how much he affected other people. As I got older, I realized there was no way around it. It was like, we're going to have to figure out how to have a relationship with this. And it was an easy relationship. Because, you know, I have my own stuff with him, but I can share in the love that everyone has for him, too, because it's just so real and honest and true.
Tell me about some of those memories that you have, because I suspect you probably got to spend some time on set and so on, but you were young, right? So I wonder how fleeting they are or how vivid they are.
Yeah, they're vivid. I think with the set times, I very much remember going on the set of Cool Runnings, the set of Only the Lonely. My sister probably remembers some different times, but I remember specifically, just how much of an orchestration it was to make a film. And, I could also just tell like there was such a camaraderie on set, and I wasn't seeing everything, but I know that, my father definitely lit up the set. And the only reason I could so confidently say that is I felt it. But then I remember, you would hear stories later about how enjoyable it was to work with him, or how he went out of his way to be a stand-up person on a set, his work ethic. And so, yeah, for me, I love being there at those times, and I got to travel to these really cool places. By the time I'm 8, I could say that I lived in Jamaica for a month. Not many kids can say that. So it was very cool. But also, I could just tell how much work went into the job at the time. And now, as I'm older and I work in that world too, you appreciate how great he had it. He was definitely a top tier actor working big movies, and what that looked like. It was awesome to be able to have a front row seat for that.
So few make it to those heights. I know you had a bit of you used to talk to John Hughes a little bit, maybe not right away, but as you got a little bit older into your teens and so on. How much did you reach out to those who knew your dad best, who had either been with him on SCTV or been around him on other projects, just to learn more about him as you got older?
Yeah, I reached out to several people, and Richard Lewis was one of them who just passed away recently.
Right, he just passed last week, right?
Yeah, and that was a big loss for me. And so was John Hughes, and this other actor. His name was Tino Insana. Tino was a character actor from Second City. And the three of them, though I reached out to Richard, the three of them went out of their way to help connect me to my father in a really beautiful way. And with John, it was reconnecting with him when I was in the sixth grade, and he connected with me personally, with my love for music. And then from there, he would just be able to tell me all of these stories about what made my dad so great in his eyes. And I really appreciated hearing them, because when you go through the kind of nightmare of that kind of loss as a kid, you kind of don't get those great stories right away. And it was really helpful. John was very helpful with that. And then Richard, who I miss and I'm still mourning that loss, he would be someone who would, initially we got to know each other, and he just shared the two projects he worked on with my father and would tell me his time with him. And but then it turned into a friendship of our own. And so we had a great connection, and he just loved my father. But then it was nice because I'd be able to then become friends with him, and have our own friendship. But everyone else from the Second City world is always there, and they're always just so comforting and lovely. It though we don't see each other all the time or keep in best contact with each other, it is very much family, and that is what is very lovely about all of those people, from the top down.
Yeah, I'm sorry about Richard Lewis. I was actually reading a very nice thing that Richard Lewis had said about your father, I think the last time, maybe on a birthday or an anniversary, and how close they were. And it's nice to hear that you had your own friendship, because in that sense, it makes it even more, well, it makes it even harder at this point, but it must have been even more gratifying to develop a friendship with someone who also knew your father, but also respected what you had done and what you were doing.
Yeah, exactly. I think that that was really nice. And Richard and my father w worked together, but they had such respect for each other. And for me, it was just, I was a fan of Richard's first, so to be able to become a friend of his was a gift. And so that was truly lovely. But yeah, it has been sad, but happy that a person like Richard is at peace.
Chris Candy is with us. He is the host of a weekly radio show on KXLW. He's an actor, producer. He's involved with improv as well in LA. He is the son of the late John Candy, who passed away 30 years ago today. We're honoring his memory. So many people reach, sort of posting on social media. There's been articles in newspapers and magazines in Canada and the US, just sort of thinking back to his incredible legacy that is as feels as enormous and as rich today as it did 3 decades ago. So how was that decision, Chris, to go through the Second City program? Because it's a tough program to get into. It's a tough one to excel at. And so many people that you'd known, your father, but many others had been through that same system. It must have been both awesome and terrifying all at once.
Yeah, I think improv is such like a beautiful art form, but it's really interesting and it takes a lot of discipline. And really, you just kind of have to get out of your own head and listen to the other performer that you're working with. And then what Second City teaches to kind of find the funny. I had done improv in Los Angeles and worked at the UCB Theater and a little bit at Groundlings. We have a really rich improv scene here in LA on the kind of indie side. And then there was an opportunity to audition for a team at Second City, and when we had a theater here in Hollywood. So I went in and auditioned, and we got put on a house team. And it was about 2 years before the pandemic. And so I had this beautiful time of being able to perform there. And what the gift was from that was just to be able to learn from a pedigree of like amazing teachers who were primarily from Chicago. And I still respect all those performers. They're just such great thinkers. And then I got the opportunity last summer to go and perform. Well, Dedicate, really, there's a theater of my father's up at the Second City in Toronto. That's the John Candy Box Theater that they moved to their new location. And then so I got to perform there, which was great. And then I got to perform with one of the house teams, and it's an honor just because it's so much fun. And all of those performers, what I think is most intimidating is some of those performers are working every night, and they're just so sharp. So to be able to just get to play with them and work with them was just a blast. And so, but I always, I like putting my time in and my work in, and I try not to be handed anything here. So I really respect all the performers that came out of that program.
Do you ever watch back? I mean, I occasionally watch the old SCTV cartoons. I mean, some of them wouldn't quite pass muster
Yeah,
culturally
sure.
anymore, but to watch them back in the day, it now seems astounding they were able to come up with so much stuff week in, week out, week in, week out. But that's the creative process, right? And I guess part of the reason John Candy and the rest of that crew were so adored in this country was because of that TV show that launched them all, because it was so creative and so, well, sometimes just bizarre, but it was so creative week in, week out, and that's not easy to do.
No, it's not. And I think, that's a great example of the kind of turn that I even had with my perspective on the creativity all of them had. But when I was younger, I didn't fully get it. And as I got older, I realized that they had kind of invented the wheel in regards to certain sketch shows. And even some of them are being, borrowed to this day on SNL and other sketch shows. And I just think it was the timing. You had lightning in a bottle with that cast and such great talent from, Catherine O'Hara and Eugene Levy, Marty Short, Dave Thomas, Joe Flaherty, Rick Moranis. I can you just go on and on and on. Andrea Martin, that's the
Yeah,
last one.
for
I
sure.
got them all.
Yep.
Robin Duke and Robin
You got them
Duke.
all. You got them all. Yeah, yeah, it's remarkable how they all went on to do well in their own ways, right? I mean,
Yeah.
some of them excelled in different ways than others, but they all went on to have really interesting careers. Did you ever, I mean, I really don't know whether you would go back and watch your father's work a lot, but do you have a certain character or a certain movie that you actually don't mind sitting down with and watching and enjoying?
I think it's safe to say that like I just really love during the holidays Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. The Del Griffith character is just the perfect John Candy character. I know a lot of people think Uncle Buck, but and it is. I mean, both of them are similar, but the Del Griffith character is just this big kid. He wears his heart on his sleeve. Every time I watch that film, I just think it's a masterpiece, and that speaks back to us talking about John Hughes and my father. It was just like, and then of course, Steve Martin, you've got just three heavy hitters in comedy working at their peak levels. And what I love about their sense of humor is that it's all encompassing of comedy. You get, kind of throwbacks to older kind of physical comedy tropes, and then all the way up to really nuanced, great joke and written word comedy. And so that movie just is, I think, a great first starting point if you're looking for a John Candy movie. I do like watching them, and I do like watching the SCTV stuff because I was going to mention that, I remember Martin Short saying this, but it was like they just could kind of get away with whatever because no one was watching them. They could just work. And since it wasn't live, they could try things. And that is so important in comedy because you can get that opportunity to really workshop something. So to understand their work ethic as they were making stuff later in life is so rad. It's awesome. You know,
yeah.
Can you tell I'm from California? It was it's very cool to just like, you know, see how they all worked. It's great.
Yeah. And just how the legacy survived. I mean, it's so appreciated even now, 30 years later, when so much about comedy has changed. And yet that era is still seen with such fondness, especially in Canada. I'm sure it's the same in LA, but there's something quite magical about your dad and SCTV and that whole cast in this country to this very day.
Yeah, they were given an opportunity to also make fun of stuff that people didn't know how to make fun of. I think if you watched television from the 70s, there's such a, you know, there's a joke waiting to happen for some of those melodramas. And then when you realize that SCTV was going, well, we see the joke and we're going to make it, you know, I think there, you know, there's just so much satire.
Your dad is Magnum.
On. Yeah,
exactly. Your dad is Magnum P.I.
Exactly. P.E.I., yeah.
The potato thief. Yeah.
Or the Prince Edward Island, or there was, excuse me, all the movie of the week stuff they would make fun of, and that stuff still exists, you know, so.
It does. It does. Chris, listen, I really appreciate your time. My condolences on the passing of Richard Lewis as well, and thank you so much.
I really appreciate it. Thank you, Ben.
President Reagan and I were alone, except for the security details. When their car drove in a moment later, out stepped Nancy and Mila, looking like a million bucks. And as they headed towards us, President Reagan beamed. He threw his arm around my shoulder, and he said with a grin, "You know, Brian, for two Irishmen, we sure married up."
Brian Mulroney delivering a eulogy to Ronald Reagan quite a few years ago now. But I was listening back to some of the eulogies that Brian Mulroney had done over the years for, you know, big names in politics of our era, both here and obviously abroad. He also delivered a eulogy for George H.W. Bush. And, you know, he just had such a way with words. But part of it was his ability not only to pay tribute, but also to share anecdotes, to share stories, to share good stories. That one being one of them. There are other ones in that same eulogy, by the way. But you know, he was just able to deliver these tributes because he was also able to make them human, to draw parallels and to share a good story at a time of grief. Obviously, you know, those are difficult moments for many. The former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, of course, passed away in Florida last Thursday at the age of 84. We don't know yet exactly what's going to happen next. We know there's going to be a state funeral and other events to mark his passing. As I mentioned, many have been looking back on his way with words since. Justin Trudeau told reporters in Sudbury, Ontario on Friday that details will come and that Canadians will have opportunities to express their gratitude in the coming days. Now, Global was reporting on Friday that the state funeral itself will actually be held in Montreal, but there will be events, we believe, in Ottawa. Other details about the repatriation of Mulroney's body from Florida, all those things have yet to be announced. We're expecting the family to confirm those details in the coming days, of course. Now, one of those who will likely be called on to speak is my next guest, a longtime colleague and dear friend, someone who considered the former prime minister to be a mentor as well. Jean Charest was first elected to parliament for the Quebec riding of Sherbrooke all the way back in 1984 in that election that saw Mulroney and the Progressive Conservatives absolutely sweep to power with 211 seats. In fact, we're coming up on the 40th anniversary of that election in September. By 1986, at just 28, Charest was appointed as Secretary of State for Youth, becoming the youngest cabinet minister in Canadian history. He would serve as Deputy Prime Minister under Kim Campbell once Brian Mulroney had resigned. He would go on to lead the same Progressive Conservatives after the decimation of the 1993 election, when Charest was one of only two MPs to hold on to their seats in the entire country, Elsie Wayne being the other one. And then later, after leaving federal politics, he would serve as Premier of Quebec for more than 9 years until 2012. He recently finished a distant second to Pierre Poilievre, of course, in the race to win the leadership of the Conservative Party of Canada. Through it all, though, Brian Mulroney was so much more than just a colleague. He was a friend. He was a mentor. He was a confidant. And it's wonderful to have Jean Charest with me now to share some of those thoughts and memories. Thank you for your time tonight.
Thank you very much, Ben.
I was thinking, Thursday, there's sort of it happens, someone passes and people are shocked and surprised and there's a lot of tributes that happen right away. But we've had the whole weekend now to sit and think about Mr. Mulroney's legacy and what he meant, to some people as a leader, but to other people such as yourself, as a friend and as a mentor. What have you made of all the tributes so far?
I'm impressed. I'm impressed on how well he's remembered and the recognition for everything that he's accomplished. A lot of the comment is a contrast of politics as it once was to politics what it has become. And he was in office at a time where there was an expectation that those who were elected had a project or had things they wanted to accomplish. And there always was theater and politics, Ben, but it wasn't entertainment the way it is today or has become. And the other part of it is how courageous he was. I mean, he really was an activist, and he pushed the country in a direction and took on a lot of controversial issues, whether it was reuniting the country in the constitutional negotiations and then free trade and then the GST. And his accomplishments on the international stage, all of that, was a very long list of accomplishments. And there was an expectation then, Ben, that if you had some political capital, you spent it, that you had a responsibility to do things. And that if you do the art of politics right, that you'll be able to navigate that and get through it. But you have to ask yourself in this environment today, would it be possible for a government to do a free trade agreement, as controversial as it was to do the GST? I just asking the question, I guess, sort of gives you an indication of how things have changed.
Indeed. I mean, you had a close personal relationship with Mr. Mulroney for so many years, and I understand that you got a chance to see him, which I thought must have been even recently, just about a week and a half ago, and that must must have been really special.
Well, he had asked, we chatted over the phone from time to time, and he said we'd agreed that we'd see each other, and I missed it because I caught a cold and I didn't want to infect him. And so, but we chatted again, and he said, you should, I'd like to see you. So I flew down on the Wednesday, and I saw him on the Saturday before he passed away on the Thursday. We had a great chat, a good chat. He was very alert. But you could tell, Ben, that he was a bit despondent. He said to me during the conversation that he didn't think he would make it through the year. And I told him, listen, this is the 40th anniversary of the election of your government. We need to organize some events to remember and to celebrate your legacy. I joked with him. I told him, I got you elected 40 years ago.
Must have loved that.
He laughed. He thought, yeah, sure. And so we talked about a number of things, of family and how he was. And I thought that if we could put this 40th anniversary in front of him, that would motivate him and encourage him, but he was obviously it was difficult for him to walk, Ben,
right?
And his heart sort of went in different directions between being a bit discouraged and then moments of more encouragement. So I was happy to see him at least before he passed away.
Yeah, I mean, having spent some time with him, not much over the years, I would never say that he struck me as someone who ever thought the job was done, that he would have wanted another 84 years just to check off all the other things he had on that list.
Oh, you're so right. I mean, he used to joke that he would run again if we were given an opportunity, and he followed politics very well. But he was very much a statesman when you look back at what he accomplished and the way he behaved, because he, this is politics. There's a lot of confrontation, but he always behaved in a way that was quite noble, and everyone recognized that and tells stories today of him reaching out. After that, he did become very much a statesman. And he was freed from the shackles of partisan politics. Always was a conservative, but always ready to help a prime minister, whether it was Mr. Trudeau or someone else. If they reached out and needed some help, what counted for him the most, certainly always, but even more so now, was the future of Canada.
What struck me about him too, and I think you're a prime example, I'll let you tell this story, is that even those who had opposed him over periods of their career, as you did as a young man, if he thought you could bring something to the table, if he respected your, you know, something about you, that he would bury the hatchet.
He did. I had supported Mr. Clark in the leadership race of 83 all the way down to the fourth ballot. Then I ran for the nomination. I was 25. His camp opposed me. They supported the other candidate. I won and then was elected and ended up becoming a deputy speaker in the House. And he got to know me and then named me to cabinet. I was only 28 years old in 1986.
Indeed.
It was. So and after that we developed a great friendship. Our families, our children know each other, and he attended my daughter's wedding, and we were there for some of his children's weddings, and all the big decisions in my life after that, you know, he was consulted or he was around. And then when I was in office and premier and leader of the opposition, he was always there to support me. But he also reached out to anyone who was in politics and who had a difficult period. And people very much appreciated that. But we all remember, though, his courage. I mean, here's someone who put himself at risk for his country. And he was very courageous in what he did. One thing, Ben, about him, I'm sure you've heard a lot about this, is how he could motivate his caucus. Mm-hmm. We would show up at the caucus meetings every week. I mean, you'd never miss that, to hear his remarks at the end of caucus. And he could be funny. He would be in, you know, and tell us about what's happening. He would inspire us. And we'd walk out of those caucus meetings. We were 15% in the polls. You'd think we were at 60%.
Yeah.
And the media thought we were on drugs or something back then.
Peter McKay was describing his father saying it was like getting a pep talk from you know, from Toe Blake and the, you know, going into the third period or halftime at the Grey Cup, that, you know, that's why. But that's why everyone stuck with him, even though the polls were pretty dismal by the end. But you know, that people firmly believed they would go to war for him. And that was pretty evident in 1993.
And he understood that politics. You know, one of the hidden secrets of politics is that it's very intense at a human level. And I don't know anyone who's been in office for whom it hasn't been one of the most exciting periods of their life. But you're there in the front row of history, and it's all in real time, Ben. And then, you know, the people you work with, you go to war with them. You cry, you laugh, you celebrate, you have victories and defeats, but you do it together. And that part of politics is extremely, extremely rewarding at a human level. Mulroney understood all of that. And he was a man of great values. When he swore me into cabinet, he asked me whether my wife Michelle was around. I said yes. And he said that he had never been Prime Minister of Canada without his wife Mila.
Yeah.
And I believe that. I think it's true. Yeah.
Jean Charest, the former Quebec Premier, former head of the Progressive Conservative Party, former Mulroney era cabinet minister, is with us this half hour. We're talking about the passing, of course, of Brian Mulroney on Thursday. I was interested to see, because you were on set for this, and I, of course, that video has been passed around a lot. Having grown up in Quebec in that era, I remember just how visceral the breakup, if we could call it that, personal and political, between Lucien Bouchard and Mr. Mulroney had been. And it was nice to see Mr. Bouchard reflect on the fact that they had, even in the last days, I mean, he spoke quite sadly, actually, about having taken way too long, but the two managed to mend fences before Mr. Mulroney passed.
That was a very dramatic moment when Lucien Bouchard resigned from cabinet and Mr. Mulroney felt betrayed. And it's something that, you know, of all the things in his political life that he was disappointed with, Meech Lake was obviously the most important thing. And so that was a very, very dramatic moment. They had been friends since their 20s. They had studied law together at Laval University. Mr. Mulroney started his public career as a commissioner on a royal commission, or the equivalent of in Quebec, on the construction industry. He had brought in Lucien Bouchard as the lawyer of the commission. He was the one who was instrumental in recruiting him. And then they were on whatever Mr. Mulroney was doing politically. Lucien was always close by, though Lucien always was a separatist and wasn't a federalist. He recruited him, he named him ambassador to Paris as our ambassador, and then back. And but for years they didn't talk, and that was a sore point. A number of people around the prime minister, around Brian, encouraged him to try to mend those fences, at least to be able to talk to him. It didn't mean he had to forgive him, but including his wife Mila, and I was among those who encouraged him to do it. And I think we were happy that he was able to, that they were able to talk at least, and partly reconcile. But it was quite important to Brian, that friendship. So it's part of life, Ben. I mean, these are the things that make a life, and for him to be able to put that partly behind him before passing away, I think was an important thing for him to do.
I was listening to, I mean, of Brian Mulroney's many gifts, whether you liked his politics or not, I don't think anyone could deny what a great speaker he was. And I was listening to some of his eulogies, the fact that he got called on to deliver a eulogy for Ronald Reagan, for George H.W. Bush, I mean, and others. I mean, he was a wonderful, wonderful speaker, and he could eulogize beautifully. I was thinking about his eulogy, and I was thinking about, well, who might be invited to give it? And I thought, well, Jean Charest would be a good idea, because it's going to have to be bilingual. It's going to have to be somebody who knew him well and you could tell share stories. Those would be big shoes to fill.
Well, it's what I'm doing, I guess, and partly what you and I are doing now is to eulogize him. And we're not yet informed on what the details are for the state funeral. We all assume he'll lie in state in Ottawa for a few days, and maybe Montreal, and the funeral would be in Montreal. But I have no doubt that the eulogies will be important moments to remember him. And you're quite right, he was a very good speaker, because he was a thoughtful speaker, Ben. He was someone who we tend to think of speakers of people who are very well spoken, but what is fundamental about a good speaker is their deep love and attachment to the subject and to what they're talking about. That's where a good speech starts. And when Brian Mulroney eulogized Ronald Reagan and George Bush, it came from the very, very, someone very deep in his soul, of saying thank you to two people and two friends who had made a difference in his life and had made a difference in the life of Canada.
Yeah. Is there a story that comes to mind? What always struck me about his eulogies was his ability to insert personal moments that he'd had with that individual. And the way he conjured up he and George H.W. walking in Kennebunkport. I think he'd gone to see him. And there'd been he of course had lost, and but his two boys, Jeb and George and Junior, had done well, become governors, and he sort of reflected on life and his happiness. And Brian Mulroney shares a very nice story about that. Is there any story that pops to mind between you and Mr. Mulroney that would really stand out?
There's a few. One of them is the first time I asked to meet him over an issue I had in my own riding, and I was in cabinet at the time, and I remember saying to him that I'm apologizing for taking his time, and he said to me, "Jean, if it's important for you, it's important for me," and that was true for every member of caucus. There's another anecdote, if time allows, that is more amusing. We in cabinet were naming a royal commission, and I had seen this happen a few times, and had taken a few notes, and intervened in the discussion, and just to amuse him a bit, and said, "I don't know why we're doing this, Prime Minister. Every time we name a royal commission, a few things happen. One of them is whatever time frame we give them, it's not enough. They ask to extend it. Two, the commissioners, whatever mandate we give them, they won't respect it. They'll go off on their own tangent. And three, when they ask to file their report, they're again going to ask for an extension. And usually the extension will be just before the general election campaign. And by the time that happens, they'll table a report that denounces us. And finally, Prime Minister, you know what they'll do? He said, what? I said, you know, then they'll run against us in the campaign. So we all laughed around the table, including the Prime Minister. And then there was a moment of silence. And he looked at me and said, you know, Jean, I started my public career on a royal commission. And I had completely forgotten. I didn't. And it was the Clich Commission in Quebec on the future. Right. I'd completely forgotten. So I said to him, never mind. Just, you know.
Forget I spoke.
But then we laughed. I mean, there was there were more much lighter moments.
Jean Charest, thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ben.
You are what you eat, the old saying goes. And new research into the consumption of ultra-processed foods suggests eating a lot of them is just not good for us. Ultra-processed foods are shortening lives, worsening people's health on at least 32 major health parameters, this new study has found. It's a review of hundreds of epidemiological studies published in the British Medical Journal, and it does bring up some really interesting stuff. Now, this is one of those issues that has been looked into quite a bit, but it's still in some senses, we're still at the beginnings of trying to find out more about what ultra-processed foods, how exactly do we define them? What exactly are they doing to us? Obviously, we're consuming a lot more of them than we used to. They include packaged baked goods and snacks, fizzy drinks, sugary cereals, ready-made meals, including that it contain food additives, dehydrated vegetable soups, reconstituted meat and fish products. And they often have a lot of added sugar, fat, and salt, don't have a lot of vitamins and fiber. The old rule of thumb is if you go to a grocery store, pick something up, look at the ingredients, and you don't recognize a lot of them, or you would never have them in your cupboard, it's probably ultra-processed. Not necessarily, but probably ultra-processed foods. Now, we spoke to physician Chris Van Tulleken on the show not that long ago. He's the author of an international bestseller called Ultra-Processed People. Here's what he had to say.
It is all around us, and it makes up, whether you're in the UK or Canada, it makes up 60% of the calories that we eat. If you've got a teenager, it could well be 80 or 90%. You know, the research probably underestimates the amount we eat, but this is our food culture. In North America and the UK, this is what we eat.
So if it's our food culture, then what exactly is it doing to us? Melissa Lane is the Alfred Deakin postdoctoral research fellow at the School of Medicine at Deakin University in Australia, and she joins us now. Melissa, thanks for your time tonight.
Thanks for having me.
This has obviously garnered a lot of interest so far since you released this. Tell me a bit about this study and what exactly you set out to find and what you did to do so.
Yeah, so this is an umbrella review of previous reviews. It's a review of reviews. And these previous reviews have pulled together, they're called meta-analyses, and they've pulled together a number of individual studies to get an overall estimate for different outcomes. So we really wanted to take a bird's eye view to see what each of these different reviews had found, because there had been a number of separate meta-analyses, but no one had actually pulled them together to see what the overall picture in terms of health looks like.
And it covers quite a number of people, right, if you take all these studies together?
Absolutely, yeah. So we had close to 10 million participants, and they were mostly adults.
When you looked at, I guess within that, an umbrella study, there are some limitations, but you also were able to have a good look at an area where I think what I've been told in the past is that there's been sort of a lack of data or a lack of information, but I suppose if you bring them all together, you start to paint a picture. What picture were you beginning to see with this umbrella study?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. So I'll start by saying that we used different tools to analyze not only the credibility of the evidence, but also the quality of the evidence. And both of these two tools have different aspects to them. One is objective, the other one is subjective, but they both have their limitations, which is why I think it's important to include both of them. And what we saw is that despite using those two tools, when you took a step back and you looked at the bird's eye view, you could see that there was this overall association pointing to higher intakes of ultra-processed food and a higher risk of adverse health outcomes. So we looked at 45 parameters, as I think you mentioned, and out of those 45 parameters, 32 were negatively associated or adversely associated with higher ultra-processed food intake. And I just think that that's really telling because, you know, this data is from across the world. It's ultra-processed food is measured using different dietary assessment tools, from food frequency questionnaires to 24-hour dietary recalls to dietary histories. So, you know, despite having samples from across the world, I will say that mostly from high-income countries, but some from South America, low to middle-income regions. And despite that diversity, there appears to be a pretty consistent link.
What were some of the health outcomes that you were noticing then?
Yeah, so in terms of the strength of evidence, the credibility I mentioned before, the evidence was strong, particularly for cardiometabolic outcomes. So thinking here of obesity and type 2 diabetes in particular, as well as common mental disorder outcomes. So this includes depression and anxiety outcomes, both when these were assessed together, as well as separately, and then early death. And the early death that we looked at related particularly to heart disease and cardiovascular related disease. So you can see that these, you know, both common mental disorders and metabolic conditions are often highly comorbid as well. So yeah, it's just a really interesting finding.
It is. And what's interesting about it too is that I think we recognize that there are a lot of ultra processed foods in and around us. Now, the term itself, actually, when we use the term UPF, it's actually not that new. We should differentiate. I mean, there are a lot of all food is essentially processed to some extent, not all, but a lot of food that we eat is processed. Not all of it is ultra processed. Was there a way of trying to maintain a parameter around what quantifies or what qualifies as UPF here?
Yeah, great question again. So there are a number of different classification tools that researchers used to identify food based on processing related criteria. But by far the most widely used across the world is what's called the NOVA food classification system. So for meta-analyses to be eligible into our umbrella review, they had to have used this NOVA food classification system. And they also had to have looked at ultra-processed food in terms of total intake, rather than what we're seeing now in the literature is, you know, these studies, they're separate kind of cohort studies, and then they'll look at total ultra-processed food intake, but then they'll also break it down into subcategories. Or they might have used a different classification system, or they might have just focused in on, you know, sugar-sweetened beverages, for example. So we really wanted to look at what if people were consuming ultra-processed foods based on this NOVA classification system, and they were consuming them in higher amounts regularly, what was their risk for health outcomes?
Right. Have you had any reaction to it so far from I suspect you'd have reaction from different corners, but have you had much reaction to the you've got a lot of coverage, but much reaction from government, industry, and so on?
I know that the UK House of Lords had quoted, so they do it, they've got a committee at the moment, and they've had experts come in over the week, and it's I'll just bring it up. I'm just going to have a look and see what it's titled. So it's about Food, Diet and Obesity Committee.
Right.
And they've actually already looked at the paper and quoted from it directly. So it is on the radar of governments. And I would say, though, it was on the radar of governments as part of the reason why they've got this committee together. And yeah, similar in Australia, we're currently looking at our Australian dietary guidelines, our national dietary guidelines, and ultra processed foods and the evidence around ultra processed foods have been identified as a priority area. So absolutely, I think it's on the watch list of many governments, particularly in the high income countries where intakes are increasing. But then in South American countries, particularly the likes of Brazil, they've been leaders and pioneers really in getting this concept of food ultra processing, not only in their dietary guidelines. I think Brazil was the first in 2014 to include this concept and a recommendation to reduce ultra processed foods intakes in place of minimally processed foods. And yeah, very, you know, strong government policies and recommendations around ultra processed foods in these South American countries, which I think we could learn a lot from.
Hey, Melissa Lane is with us right now from Deakin University in Australia, talking about an umbrella study that they've done, which is a huge study on the health impacts of ultra-processed foods. It's an umbrella study involving about 10 million people total. If you take all those studies put together, it found, in a nutshell, that greater exposure to ultra-processed food was associated with a higher risk of adverse health outcomes, especially cardiometabolic, common mental disorders, and mortality outcomes. Melissa, did you... I should know this. Did you have recommendations at all about where we should be going with your findings and how to continue? Because I gather, again, one of the issues here is we just need to do more research.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was definitely part of our recommendation. So we had noted that the evidence is sufficient for government and funding bodies to start really prioritizing research in this space to figure out exactly how these foods are impacting our health. You know, what is it about them? Are there particular ultra processed foods that we should be avoiding, and what ingredients do they contain? What are their precise attributes? But we also recommended that the evidence is sufficient for governments and public health recommendations to start targeting and aiming the reduction of ultra processed foods through different measures. And we give an example of what has been done, particularly in South American countries. And also noted that, you know, organizations like the World Health Organization already recommend limiting added sugar intake. So there definitely were clear recommendations for policy action needed now, in addition to mechanistic research.
Right. I suppose one of the things that's come up quite often, at least it did in my conversations on this, is labeling, right? Is just trying to make sense of what is in something. Because I think oftentimes where people start to get confused is just by the labeling itself. It's not that it's they don't list what's in there, but understanding what those labels mean.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, South American countries really have done so well in this, in terms of putting black hexagon labels on the front of their products that are high in calories and high in salt, sugar, and fat. And I think, you know, that's where the policy actions are moving, would be toward those sorts of products, because we know that there is very clear evidence over many years that foods or consumables that are high in salt, sugar, and fat, which the majority of ultra-processed foods are, have a negative impact on our bodies and our biology. So that would be absolutely a good place to start. And I just don't think it's enough to start recommending, you know, that individuals are checking ingredients lists themselves. There's just too many products out there. And not only that, but many branded ultra processed foods come with health claims. And that, you know, they might well you know, be within their rights in terms of nutrient profile, but the emerging evidence beyond nutrients, you know, the additives you talked about before, and the impact of just the methods of ultra processing, we still don't know exactly how those aspects of ultra processed foods impact our health. So that's where we really need, leadership from governments to implement things like marketing restrictions and front of packet warning labels.
Yeah, because I think what's been talked about from the get-go here is that this, of course, is very big business, right? And sometimes it's incredible to think that that's something that we consume so much of something that we don't necessarily know enough about.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly right.
Yeah. Where do you go from here then? I mean, this study is done. It's still getting a lot of attention. What next is this it, or are you going to follow up on this one?
No. So we're currently actively looking into certain aspects and components of ultra processed foods that are common. So in particular, non-sugar sweeteners and their impact on mental health. And would really love to see more clinical trials in this space. And that's something that we're actively working on as well. And I hope that that's the case, and I understand that that is the case for other researchers across the globe.
And I suppose your message to Canada's government, much like any other government, is that they should be at least paying attention to this.
Absolutely. Pay attention, you know, provide some education on what ultra-processed foods are through things like dietary guidelines. And I think, you know, health messaging in terms of media needs to be really careful and sensitive as well. You know, we don't want to create panic. But I do think just going back to basics and really asking people, reminding people to prioritize freshly made, unprocessed and minimally processed foods, and focusing on how they can add those types of foods into their diet, with whether it's fresh, frozen, or tinned vegetables, legumes, beans, back to basics, really.
Yeah. I mean, of course, we know. I mean, Australia is just like Canada right now. There's an affordability issue, and oftentimes ultra processed food is a little bit less expensive. It's more convenient. So all the recipe is there for people to want to go buy it. It's alluring. I think just if they have more knowledge, then that's a good start.
Yeah, absolutely. And this idea that you have to be eating raw organic food is not a message that I personally would want to be pushing at all. As I mentioned before, fresh, frozen, or tinned where possible, those foods are, completely legitimate in terms of, nutrient profile. And just because it's not, doesn't necessarily have to be fresh, particularly for places like Canada where you have lots of snow and you might not be able to grow fresh vegetables as much as we can over here in Australia. So access is definitely an issue, and that's why I think being sensitive to those factors is really important.
Yeah, indeed. Well, Melissa, thank you so much for your time tonight.
Thank you so much for having me, Ben.
Back off.
No, you back off.
This is my swamp.
Our swamp.
Let go, donkey.
You can't go.
Stubborn jackass.
Smelly ogre.
Fine.
Hey, 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 come back here. I'm not through with you yet.
Well, I'm through with you.
Uh-uh. You know what? You is always me, me, me. Well, guess what? Now it's my turn. So you just shut up and pay attention. You are mean to me. You insult me and you don't appreciate anything that I do. You're always pushing me around or pushing me away.
Oh, yeah? Well, if I treated you so bad, how come you came back?
Because that's what friends do. They forgive each other.
Shrek, of course. Eddie Murphy and Mike Myers there, I believe. Am I going to get that wrong? I wanted to share, we've been talking about John Candy tonight. Great comedic actor, speaking of. And Derek in Edmonton says, Spaceballs and Uncle Buck have always been my favorite John Candy movies. Let me know yours, 1-877-399-9898. John Candy movies is our topic tonight. Friends is our topic now. You know, friendship is not something we keep hidden. It's certainly not something we never talk about. In fact, it's at the center of many things that we do. We often talk about our friends. We experience the same kind of ups and downs, attachments, fallings out, falling out, arguments, as you were just listening to that. That's not a real one, but still, a fictional one, but it says what it needs to say. We do that with our friends just like we do with our romantic partners, right? So my next guest asks and then went out to find out why we so often assume that romantic relationships are more important than friendships. And what if we didn't think that way? What if we put friendship at the center, depending on the relationship, of course. But if we did that, if we put friendship at the center of our lives, for instance, in certain circumstances, what could we learn about commitment and love and many other things? And what could we learn about those things from those who've actually done it, who've carved out a central, if not the central place in their lives, not for a romantic partner, but for a friend? Raina Cohen went out to explore this idea in a new book called The Other Significant Others. It's a great title. Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center. It began as work that she did for The Atlantic magazine. It blossomed into this book. And in it, she not only explores the meaning of deep friendships, but also heads out to find and speak with those who defied convention to some extent by choosing a friend as a life partner. Now they co-parent, they own homes together, they move for each other, they grow old together, they make plans together, they are each other's chosen caregivers, they often give each other power of attorney, and so on. Now keep in mind, these are not romantic relationships. They are not. In every way, they are as close, but they are platonic. They are not sexual relationships. That too, obviously, is often misunderstood. But it was based on lots of original reporting that she's done. She also dug into the social science on this. And Cohen's main point is that we undermine our romantic relationships by expecting too much of them, while we diminish our friendships by expecting too little of them. And it hasn't always been this way. It's something that sort of really crept up in the last 125 years or so, that there was a time when many people thought of friendship a bit differently. Of course, these days as well, we're a lot more of us are spending large stretches of our lives either, you know, single, widowed, divorced, and so on. And we've talked a lot about a loneliness epidemic out there. So what an interesting way of looking at friendship and how we could or should put friendship in a much higher spot when it comes to our pecking order of relationships. So Raina Cohen, journalist and author, producer at National Public Radio, NPR in the States. Again, her book is called The Other Significant Other, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center. And she joins me now. Raina, thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
I always enjoy a good origin story. So as one begins your book, the origins of this book become clear. I mean, you've written about this in the past, so it's not the first time you've tackled the topic. But this idea of a very busy wedding season and something that struck you about the way that vows work these days and how they often mention the word friend. And that sort of got you thinking about what is a friend?
Well, after the pandemic kind of quieted a little bit, ended up having a ton of weddings and sort of saw this pattern where at the altar, the bride and groom-to-be would refer to each other as their best friend, which I guess these days might not really stand out to people because it is so common for people to talk about their romantic partner as their best friend. But there was a particular wedding where I was thinking about this because the groom and his best man had known each other longer than the bride and groom. And I saw the best man behind, you know, the altar. And I was wondering, like, what was he thinking in that moment? Like, it just felt like he had gotten publicly demoted. And yeah. I wondered, why does a spouse have to be your best friend? Why has that become the ideal?
Yeah, or necessarily, you always think of the rituals of a wedding as sort of the father handing off the bride to the groom. You never think of the best man handing off his best friend to the bride.
Yeah, I mean, at least there would be some sort of acknowledgement of a transition, but it is pretty unceremonious. And if you can't even have a best friend to be a friend, you're like, best friend is already in this other category, the romantic category, which is on top. Like, where does that relegate friendship to? It communicates, I guess, in my mind, that friendship is at such a subsidiary role. And in fact, it doesn't have to be that way. There are all sorts of very intimate friendships and committed friendships out there, whether or not we recognize them publicly.
Yeah. And you've spoken about this often. We have this notion of friendship as sort of being a soft topic. We don't even really have a lot of language around friendship to compare to romantic relationships. I think you touch on this a lot, this idea of the expectations around romantic friendship, romantic love, and how we sort of relegate friendship to second place. It was a contradiction that you had trouble trying to square.
Well, I think that if you look in sort of the sweep of history, you can see that marriage and friendship have not always been in this hierarchy that we see today, that there have been plenty of times where marriage was not expected to be the most significant relationship in a person's life, and where friendship was maybe had the starring role in a person's life, was the most emotionally intimate relationship that they had, which, you know, suggests to me that this is the way things are now it's not intrinsic to the way that these relationships work, and that it is instead possible to have friendship take up more space in our lives, and also for romantic relationships to not have so much pressure on them to take on every single significant role in our lives.
Right. And so with that in mind, you set out to write this book, right? I mean, you decide that this is something that needs to be talked about in a way that, and it struck me that it was odd that we haven't talked about it as much, considering how central friendship is in all our lives, really.
I think there's a disconnect between how people experience friendship and how we talk about it publicly. Mm-hmm. I mean, friendship is really a private relationship in our society. We don't have rituals to commemorate it, let alone rituals to note when they're, you know, getting relegated to second place, as you were describing in the wedding scenario. This has not always been true across history. I think one of the most interesting historical cases that I looked at were this practice of sworn brotherhood, which mm-hmm. was a ritual where in a church, men would be turned into brothers in the you know, eyes of the church and the community, and that was done before others. But when we don't have any rituals around friendship today when it is supposed to just be something that you and another person do together. And there is a hierarchy of relationships that doesn't really leave much opportunity for people to express how much their friends mean to them. And I've seen this disconnect come up when I've started doing interviews like this, where a number of the people who have interviewed me or asked questions at events will talk about a friendship that they've maybe told other people is their best friend, but they didn't really go into detail with the people in their lives about, well, I've moved across the country for this friend, or mm-hmm. when this friend and I had this, you know, falling out, it was more devastating than a romantic breakup, or, you know, and so on. So we just sort of don't talk to each other about how much our friends mean, which reinforces people not talking to each other because they don't think others will understand it.
Oscar, you're asking to hear something I don't want to say. But if I do say it, I think you ought to hear it.
You got anything on your chest besides your chin, you better get it off.
All right, then you asked for it. You're a wonderful guy, Oscar. You've done everything for me. If it weren't for you, I don't know what would have happened to me. You took me in here, you gave me a place to live, you gave me something to live for. I'm never gonna forget you for that, Oscar. You're tops with me.
If I've just been told off, I think I may have missed it.
It's coming. You are also one of the biggest slobs in the world.
Raina Cohen is a journalist and author, producer at NPR, and her book is called The Other Significant Others, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center. So Raina, you start out with this thesis, this idea, and I think you've featured examples of it in some of your earlier writing in The Atlantic and so on, but then you go to really try and find examples of what this looks like in real life, what this sort of intense friendship looks like in real life. What were your criteria as what would qualify? And you found some pretty amazing examples.
I was interested in friendships that had the commitment and the caregiving involved in a romantic relationship, that basically a friendship that so closely resembled a partnership that it would be hard to sort of separate the two other than the absence of sex in the friendship. And I would say one of the other criteria I was interested in was people looking toward a shared future together and making decisions together, like owning a home, maybe raising kids, taking care of each other through illness. So this sort of abiding devotion.
Yeah. And you went out and found examples of people who are very much in committed friendships. It's odd that we struggle to find the right words because we don't have a huge vocabulary around this, but, you know, very committed friendships.
Yeah, I mean, even I remember at one point trying to describe these as committed friendships, but then the term committed also means like committed to an asylum or like, right. Like it is very hard. And I use the term platonic partnerships to have at least some kind of shorthand or shared language. But it is, yeah, outside the realm of the lexicon that we have to talk about the relationships that really matter.
And the examples that you found, and I think people mightn't be surprised, because it's funny, many people that I know have friendships that they're not quite as intense as the ones that you described in the book, but they're certainly the kinds of friendships that go far beyond what one would consider to be sort of someone I have a beer with now and then.
Well, you know, I guess maybe to give one example that I think is telling, I write about these two women who are in their 80s at this point and have been best friends for about 50 years. And to give you an idea of their commitment, they have lived together for about half that time. So when they were on the cusp of retirement, decided to buy a home together. And they have taken care of each other through the deaths of loved ones, through major illnesses. They deliberately go to the same primary care doctor to make sure that they're really up to speed on what's going on with each other. They have one email address between the two of them. So I really have to be careful when I'm figuring out who I'm addressing my email response to. One of them has children and the other has acted as very much in a parental role to the child and was a godparent to one of them. So they are kind of like very interdependent and have been for a long time. And it's really hard when I look at their friendship to understand how is this not a partnership? Like, why is this a relationship that is completely invisible to us? And, you know, where these women are, for all intents and purposes, legal strangers to each other when they are, you know, as devoted as spouses would be.
Yeah, it's interesting. We'll talk about some of the challenges that the lack of recognition of friendship, the bonds of friendship, bring in a second. But when you spoke to these friends, these pairs, was there anything that unified? Was there a thread that unified their decision to sort of make to live these lives together in partnership when many others don't do it for whatever reason?
Often, at least one person in one of these pairs would have something about who they are or their life circumstances that made it such that kind of the conventional path was not available to them. And they had reason to be more creative, more open-minded. So, you know, this includes somebody who realized that he was asexual. So like a kind of conventional romantic relationship wasn't going to be in the cards for him. Somebody who decided to be celibate for religious reasons. Someone who decided to become a single mom by choice. And then her friend really stepped in as a co-parent. You know, someone who never got married. So there are other cases where, you know, friends have romantic partners in addition to these friendships, and they really did have the option available to them to lead a kind of more conventional partnership in their lives. And they were just so connected to the friend that that was where their priority was. But at least, you know, in the sample that I was looking at, so often there was some kind of outside force that really encouraged them to be open-minded to the possibility that a non-romantic figure in their life could be this important.
Yeah, a soulmate at times is the word that is brought up. What was the reaction then from those around them? Because I guess one of the reasons that you tackled this topic in the first place was this whole misunderstanding around that sort of bond within a platonic relationship.
It kind of runs the gamut, but there's certainly a lot of suspicion of these sorts of friendships. And I think that's especially true when you're dealing with straight men and also for younger people for whom, you know, the expectation is that they're going to orient their worlds around a romantic partner, that that's the focus of that period of life. So for a couple of these men who I interviewed for the book named Andrew and Tolly, I mean, their friendship has really bewildered people around them. And Andrew's mother at several points had asked him, you know, in different ways, is this relationship romantic? And he told her in no uncertain terms that it wasn't, and was trying to understand why she was so interested in that and kind of focusing on his dating life or what, you know, if he was dating. And she said that she wanted him to have the kind of emotional happiness that she knew, which was through a romantic partnership. And when Andrew said that he had that just through his friendship, she just couldn't understand it, or it took her a long time to understand that it is possible to have a partner when there isn't romance involved. So I think that kind of reaction is pretty common. I've also, you know, seen how people face consequences in their jobs, where the subjects of gossip were not let into the hospital, or ended up having frustrating conversations with people like doctors who are in a position of authority about the nature of their relationship. There are certainly cases where people, you know, who get to see the friendship up close look on longingly and really have a lot of admiration for them. But, you know, I am certainly concerned with trying to reduce the stigma, the misunderstanding that accompanies these sorts of friendships.
Well, do you guys have to go to the new house right away, or do you have some time? We got some time. Okay, should we get some coffee?
Sure. Okay. Where?
Raina Cohen is with us this half hour. We're talking about her book called The Other Significant Others, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center. This is something that Raina's been writing about for quite some time. It was born of a personal experience, a very close friend of hers in D.C. when she was living there at the time. And that's an interesting story. I mean, one of the things I was really interested about is you could sort of say, okay, well, this is the way it is, and maybe it's okay. But you bring up some really interesting examples of the harm that it can do. I mean, not just obvious things, you know, not having power of attorney, for instance, and friendships not being recognized when it is the most important relationship in someone's life at a very critical time when other people don't, when they're not recognized legally, as you pointed out, but also just when they don't work out and when they fall apart. I mean, the idea that we just don't recognize the centrality of friendship sometimes does do a lot of damage, both in many ways, as you pointed out in the book.
I think about friends who are dealing with any kind of loss as really suffering at least two harms. There is the loss of the friendship and, you know, everything that came with it, the sense of connection, the sense that, you know, there is a future that they were going to have together that they won't anymore. But on top of that, which I don't think people who have lost a sibling or a spouse or a parent have to deal with is the disenfranchised grief portion of it. The sense that people don't know what the loss was. They're not going to be there to help you grieve it. There aren't resources like couples therapy to deal with conflict, or, you know, there are not rituals or greeting cards or ceremonies like, you know, sitting Shiva or prayers and so on that are connected to grieving the loss of a friend. So it's extraordinarily painful from what I've seen for people to suffer a loss and have that loss really invalidated.
Yeah. And you mentioned some of the more sort of concrete pains that it brings to, for instance, friends who aren't able. I mean, you pointed, I think it might have been in the Atlantic article, that oftentimes when someone is at the end of their lives, the person sitting at their side is a friend, not a spouse. I mean, and if you look at the statistics around divorce and so on, it almost goes without saying that that might be true. And yet we don't recognize it. So for instance, if you know, often friends would be left out of being able to help at the end of life and so on.
Yeah, I mean, that sort of observation about the end of life came from talking to a couple of doctors who I encountered who work with patients who are older. And when I was talking to a director of a hospice who affirmed the same sort of thing, even when there might be legal rights for friends to get into the hospital, often I've heard that like nurses and, you know, sort of the people who have the decision-making power in practice don't actually recognize it. And one story that I tell in the book is how these two women who I mentioned earlier, who are in their 80s, have been best friends for 50 years, live together, take care of each other, had a very undignifying moment in the hospital when one of them, Inez, ended up having to go to the emergency room, and her friend Barb had her medical and legal power of attorney rights, but was not let into the hospital as far as they can tell, because they don't have blood ties. And, you know, later on a nurse came and was looking for the person who had medical power of attorney rights and was let in. But she literally had to sit out in the cold on a winter day at the moment that her friend was in distress. So there are real concrete harms to friendship being seen as this real second status relationship, and always being assumed to be a second status relationship, and not questioning that maybe there are going to be exceptions to that rule, especially at the end of life when, you know, I could say at least in the US, about a third of women over 65 in the US are widowed, and about one half are unpartnered. So like who are going to be the people by their bedsides? And most often it's probably, or very often it's not going to be a spouse.
Yeah, similar statistics in Canada. To flip it on its head, one of the other things that comes out too in your writing is that we're living through a time, and this has, I think, particularly been talked about when it comes to men, in a friendship recession. And that oftentimes the same sorts of attitudes towards friendship that you've been pointing out on the opposite side of the coin are damaging to others as well, who don't have friends or who don't see friendship as being particularly important, therefore, or there's a social construct that doesn't allow them to see friendship as being an answer to some of the loneliness that we see out there, and how that plays in as well.
Well, you know, certainly if as a society we treat friendship as this optional add-on to your life and not something that is essential, and we don't kind of have any way of recognizing friendship, taking it seriously, it's not surprising that we're going to end up in a society where a lot of people don't have friends. One of the consequences is that that puts a ton of pressure on the romantic partnership. And, you know, there's also a bit of a gender imbalance in this, the friendship recession that you're describing, that it is often men who have no friends or very few friends, and that they end up turning to their wives and their girlfriends for emotional intimacy that they are not getting from their friends. And they're also not able to give to their friends. And, you know, I don't think that that's good for the men to not have more forms of support in their lives. And it's not good for the women in these heterosexual relationships who are having to bear so much burden.
Yeah. I one of the examples you bring up that I thought was very pointed was the example of the TV show called Friends, that at the end of it, they all just sort of go their separate ways. I always wondered what happened to Joey in all that, since he was the one, I guess he wasn't, if I'm remembering back to the final episode correctly, but just even in an episode as central, where the whole plot centered around the idea of friendship, even that friendship is all of a sudden pushed to a secondary role when the show winds up.
I mean, the show is called Friends. Like, if you can't even have a show called Friends be about friends, that's, you know, a bit of a problem. So, yeah, I mean, one of the kind of things that happens in the course of the series is Monica and Chandler partner up, and Monica, who had been living with her best friend, Rachel, asks Rachel to move. And they have this, you know, episode where Rachel has to pack up her things and is really resistant, but she has no say in the matter. And the expectation is that the romantic relationship is going to come first. And then at the end of the series, Chandler and Monica move off to the suburbs. So it's a pretty, I think, maybe realistic, but kind of disappointing way to wrap up a series that has celebrated and showcased friendship in a way that has been iconic.
When you dug into this, how much do you think sort of popular culture has fed into this? Because you do mention accurately that, you know, more than a century ago, people having their friend as the center of their life, when marriage wasn't seen as being the be all, your romantic relationship wasn't supposed to fulfill every aspect of your life. In fact, oftentimes in sort of arranged marriages, it wasn't expected to at all, or could, but didn't have to, that our attitudes about friendships, at least within popular culture, have shifted in a relatively short period of time.
Well, you know, I think there are differences across pop culture, and there are some good examples. And I think actually some contemporary examples of friendship on TV and some in movies gave me a sense that, yeah, people must have this friendship. Like, they're basing these storylines off of something, like the movie Booksmart or the TV show Broad City. That, you know, both of those have these really intimate friendships, the TV show Scrubs. But I don't think it's true across the board. Like, music, it's so hard to find songs about friendship. I mean, we're basically, I think we've got Carole King from, what, 50 years ago, who wrote a great song, but like,
and Randy Newman, I guess.
I mean, I've been on a number of radio shows, and like, it's one or the other. Those are the songs that they play to do the intros, because there aren't that many choices. And I don't think that that's representative of the way people feel about their friends. And, you know, again, I think this goes to the disconnect of how people feel privately, but what is expected in terms of public expression. And then when you don't see your feelings reflected outside in the world, then you're not likely to express them. And then it sort of perpetuates this cycle where we have this really inaccurate view of what friendship does, or at least can mean to us.
Yeah, when I was looking through it, I always thought "Lean on Me" was the best friendship song, because it doesn't suggest just being friends; it suggests something a little deeper, right? That was that was my choice.
Yeah, but I mean, again, like, we're going back quite a few decades to get these
well, we
songs.
Are. I think that's
like classics. It would be there are some songs here and there, but, you know, think about the number of songs that are about falling in and out of love, of being crushed by heartache. Well, Friends, they can inspire very intense emotions too.
Your friendship was something I never expected at this point in my life, and I could never have asked for a better surprise.
That's how we feel, too.
I have to go.
Dorothy, is this goodbye?
I love you. Always.
Raina Cohen is a journalist and author. Her book is called The Other Significant Others, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center. So, Raina, I know this, when you put out a book like this, I can only imagine the amount of people that have come to you to share their stories about how they've seen themselves in your book, or learned something from what they've read in your writing. Now, what would you like the impact of this to be?
I would like people to feel less isolated and less like oddballs if they feel so strongly for their friends, which I'm starting to see glimmers of. That, you know, I did an event in New York, and my moderator asked several questions of the crowd. And one of them was, have you ever had a friendship that you felt like other people didn't understand? And there was just this like vigorous nodding and the sounds of assent. And, you know, I heard from someone afterwards who was there and felt like she was in a room full of people who felt the same way that she did. And I hope that the book gives more space for people to acknowledge the ways that friendship can profoundly shape our lives and can help us grow, and where we can feel intense love and where we can be heartbroken, that we experience the full gamut of emotions, and also that we can turn to friends for the most important roles and aspects of our life.
Yeah, and I thought of it too, just within the context of the loneliness epidemic that's talked about a lot. But because so many of us sort of find social connection online now, that sometimes I guess people find a certain replacement there. But having a close friend sometimes can be that human contact that we miss in our lives. And if you don't have a romantic relationship, not that one may be better than the other, but if you find yourself, instead of striving for that romantic relationship to answer all your all your needs, having friends could be an incredibly important part of that social connection that we have less of, period, these days.
I also think, I think you should have friends for their own sake. I also think it doesn't bode very well for a romantic relationship if you are coming into it with a sense that there is some giant hole that you're trying to fill, as opposed to you have a full life that you want to share with another person and that you are not, incomplete without somebody else. I think that kind of language that is so common about being complete or finding your other half can, make romantic relationships more fragile when it would actually sort of help the situation to have really full, fulfilled lives where we have multiple people who know us and can bring out different sides of us, and where friendships can be not in the background, not just the extras in the, dramas of our lives.
Yeah, an option at least, right? I mean, it's each their own when it comes to who they want to choose as their best friend or how much they want to get, sort of sacrifice or abandon friendships in the name of romantic love. I mean, I suppose we each live according to our own thoughts and so on. But now that you've gone through this process and the book is out there and you're doing the book tours and so on, what is the one thing that you've walked away with from this whole experience that you didn't expect? Because I think you had reading your earlier writing, I think you had some pretty good notions of what you were looking to find out. Is there anything you found out that you really didn't expect to?
I think one thing that I've been moving toward over the last maybe a few months is I'm getting a lot of questions about sort of how do you make friends? How do you make closer friends?
Right.
And it's not a how-to book. So some of this these are new questions for me, but I've been thinking about how do we structure our lives so that friendship is easier. I think it's important for us to get used to having hard conversations with friends. But in terms of how do you become close to people? Well, you become close when you're seeing them all the time. I mean, anyone who's lived in a kind of residential setting for college or, gone to a summer camp has probably experienced this. It's so much easier to become close to people that way. And I can say, certainly in the US, that our infrastructure was really set up for nuclear families, for the kind of privacy and isolation. And I'm interested in, how can we as individuals and as a society foster living setups that make it easy to be in frequent contact with friends.
Yeah. Raina, I really appreciate your time. It's a fascinating topic. And thank you so much for sharing all that you found out about it. I appreciate it tonight.
Well, it's great to talk about it and just hear how much it's brought up for you.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.